Moncrief on News Talk.
The name Nene Ong Abbey might not be familiar to you, but it's another way of referring to Eamon de Valera. During a stay in the US attempting to raise funds for the War of Independence, a Native American community made him a chief. That's just one story from Colm Kenny's new book, Dangerous Ambition, The Making of Eamon de Valera. Colm will be in conversation about this book in the RDS Library this Saturday at 1 p.m. as part of the Dublin Book Festival. Colm, good afternoon.
Hello, and how are you?
It's a kind of an, I suppose, an, would it be an odd thing to do if he's trying to, if he's on a high-profile campaign around the United States trying to raise money, why go to a reservation?
Well, it probably was indeed in 1919. Native Americans, or Indians as they were more commonly known, were not exactly highly regarded. So for him to go out of his way to a distant place in Wisconsin to meet 3,000 Red Indians and be made a chieftain, an actual chieftain, he stressed time and time again when he spoke about it, not an honorary one. And it was an amazing thing for him to do. But it came from the fact that he had harboured this ambition since he was a lonely child in County Limerick, sent back by his mother from New York, where she couldn't look after him, to be reared by an uncle. And he used to be out minding the cows as a child, and he read a lot. And he read Robinson Crusoe, but he also seems to have formed a very strong view that he wanted to be an Indian chieftain. And he dreamt of this. He often spoke later of how he dreamt of it and how he thought it never could happen. But Harry Boland made it happen when they went to America for most of the War of Independence to raise money for the Irish Republicans. He ranged across America talking to vast crowds, but he went out of his way, especially to go to Wisconsin for this ceremony.
And how was it set up?
It seems to have been set up by priests. There was an Indian priest, a rare thing, a Native American priest, who had been involved, I think, in as a chaplain in World War One. There were Red Indians or Native Americans fought in the First World War, a fact that's not always remembered. And he was close to an Irish priest in Spooner, Wisconsin. And for some reason, they seemed to be the instrument of setting it up. But when de Valera got there, he attended a mass for Native Americans who had died in the war. But then he went out onto the plain in the open air in the vast semicircle of clergymen and chieftains, with men beating tom-toms and tribesmen in full regalia of paint and feathers dancing around the guests. They even tried to make him a blood brother, but he told us, one of his sons later, that he dodged that. Apparently he didn't want to actually mix his blood with someone else's blood that day. But he was very proud of the fact, and there's a great photograph in the book, and it's reproduced in the Daily Mail today, of de Valera in the headdress that he got on that occasion. And this was very important because de Valera was known, maybe younger people wouldn't know this, I mean, the most powerful politician in Ireland in the 20th century. He was known as the chief to virtually everybody. C.S. Andrews, who was very high up in Fianna Fáil, once wrote that irrespective of the positions of responsibility they held, when de Valera was in power, they used to never call him by his first name. They virtually always called him the chief. There were very few exceptions to that. Mm-hmm. And he had dreamed of this honour all his life, and it was fulfilled that day in October 1919.
Yeah, and from the point of view of the Native Americans, did they see him and, you know, the Irish struggle in general? Did they see these people as kindred spirits?
I don't know if they did. I think that, I mean, there were some comments made at the time that they were real Sinn Féiners, believe it or not. I mean, when Dev stood up and spoke to them, you know, he spoke to them at first in Irish. And the Irish World paper, which was seems to have been the one paper that actually reported this event, and Irish newspaper subsequently copied it, said he was, you know, there was an owlish silence when he finished speaking in Irish. They were either stunned or highly impressed, but he switched immediately to English and he explained to them, "I speak to you in Gaelic because I want to show you that though I am white, I am not of the English race. We, like you, are a people who have suffered, and I feel for you with a sympathy that comes only from one who can understand as we Irishmen can." So he saw that there was some kind of empathy, perhaps, between the two peoples. But it's a bit difficult to see what that might have meant in practice.
Yeah, but though, if you're trying to ingratiate yourself with Irish America and America in general, at least the people with the money, pointing out that they're oppressing parts of their own population, that mightn't go down too well, I would have thought.
Well, that's the surprising thing, but he seems to feel he could afford to do so. He was met with absolutely remarkable enthusiasm by Irish America. He had survived, of course, he was the surviving symbol of 1916, and he was introduced all over America as President of Ireland, which was not actually his title. He was President of the Éireann Éireann, and vast numbers of people turned out to see him. So I suppose he felt he was doing so well that he could afford to indulge this kind of infant fantasy, if you like, that he had, that he would be a real chieftain one day. He brought back the headdress to Ireland, and he brought back bow and arrows that he had been given. And the odd thing was, despite the honour he felt had been bestowed on him, he let his kids play with these, according to one of his sons, and they were eventually wrecked and apparently just disintegrated. He, in turn, sent the Indians 7 rifles to thank them for the ceremony, and he made sure, or Harry Boland possibly made sure, that they got the names of the Native Americans correct on the rifles, where each of them was inscribed, and apparently this was made a great impression on the Ojibwe tribe, or the Chippewa as they were then known. But the Cree and the Sioux Indians came down from Minnesota too. I mean, it was a real big day out for both the Christian Native Americans and the pagan Native Americans, as they were described in the Irish World newspaper report.
And and just to be clear about this, this was still a rare honour to be made a chief. It wasn't, they didn't get, like, give it out to every randomer who swung past.
No, it was extraordinarily unusual and had only happened a couple of times before. They were honoured by it, the Irish, but they also could afford to joke about it, because De Valera told his friend Dorothy McCardle during the 1930s that later that night, Harry Boland and Liam Mellows, another famous Irishman who were on tour with him in the United States, came into his room when he was in bed that night with red paint on them and towels around their waists, and did a war dance and demanded to be made braves. So it's a different side of De Valera. It's one of the stories that fascinated me writing this book, Dangerous Ambition, because I wanted to see what had made De Valera as a child, sent home as he was when his mother couldn't cope, living alone in New York and bringing him up. What had formed his character? I mean, we've had some very good biographies of De Valera, David McCullough, Tim Pat Coogan, and so on, but they tend to concentrate on the later political period. There was a long life there before that, and it formed his character, and it's full of really interesting stories and great records in the UCD archives, which I got access to, letters and so on, correspondence with his mother in America, who he wanted to go back to join after she married and had 2 other children, and she never took him back. So he grew up with a very stark and severe existence in a labourer's cottage in County Limerick, and pulled himself up by the bootstraps. I mean, he got into Blackrock College, and he went on to get a degree from the Royal University of Ireland, and there must have been very, very few people from that social background. So he had an extraordinary personality, but these stories, I think, cast light on his loneliness and his uniqueness in some ways.
Yeah, and it's because the whole thing sounds very un-De Valera-ish, in the sense our view of him is he's quite an austere, very serious person.
Well, there's a lot of things that were un-De Valera-ish, because later on the image of De Valera was, of course, was sculpted to conform to certain ideas of who he was. I mean, do you think of De Valera as a man who played rugger for 10 years for Black Rock? I don't think you do, but he did. And I talk about this in the book too, rugby playing Eamon De Valera. I mean, he was known as Eddie. He didn't become Eamon until much later. He didn't adopt that form of name. He was a man, you know, who had very much his own ambitions in life. He wanted most of all to be a professor of mathematics. He didn't get interested in politics until he was in his 30s. These are kind of fascinating aspects to him. Yeah. He had a bit of a genius for mathematics, perhaps it was exaggerated by some of his followers. I mean, there was a story told that Einstein once said that only 14 people in the world understood his theory of relativity, and that De Valera was one of these. The skeptics used to say, well, actually, there was only two people in the world understood Einstein's theory of relativity, Einstein and De Valera. And indeed, you know, there were even doubts about Einstein himself.
Colm, thanks a million for speaking with us today. That was Colm Kenny there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.